National security analysts typically ground their work in a deep appreciation of history, context, and contemporary politics. Today's guest adds a sophisticated understanding of nuclear weapons and the states seeking them to describe a catastrophic potential future of the U.S. relationship with North Korea. He's Jeffrey Lewis this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, a scholar at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California, and the author of a chilling new book, the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attack Against the United States. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So we should say this is a speculative novel, right? This is not a work of nonfiction, although you're a scholar and academic. Why write a speculative novel about such a horrible potential outcome?
Well, I mean, the thing about being an academic is you write papers that no one reads. That it's very difficult to try to take something as crazy as a nuclear war and explain to people how that might come about rationally, even if everybody is trying to avoid it. So I always found it was much easier to show, not tell. And in the end, I just decided that fiction was a better place to explain how North Korea thinks about nuclear weapons and how things might go wrong.
So we'll take a deeper look at the book in a second. Let's take a step back, though, and talk about you and how did you come to be interested in arms control, nuclear security issues?
It's a strange thing, right? It's the kind of thing that if you're interested in at a cocktail party and somebody asks you what you do and you tell them, suddenly their drink is empty and
it's
they need to go away.
It's a conversation killer, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Down into the basement, into the bomb shelter.
Right? Yeah, that's right. But I've always really liked it. And I think the things that I like about it are it's a field that's very technical, but it rewards the time you invest, because the more you study, the more you realize you don't know. So I think maybe there are some fields where people feel like they have a good handle on it. The longer I do it, the less I realize I know. And to me, that's really fascinating.
Interesting.
So you have a blog, which seems to be one of the best arms control blogs there is, and it's called Arms Control Wonk, armscontrolwonk.com. You started that way back when, and you're still doing it. Tell us about that, the origins, and what it does today.
Yeah, well, that actually kind of goes back to this cocktail party idea, where,
There's a lot of drinking.
Well, that's the thing about Washington,
there's
right?
A recurring theme.
Yeah.
I'm starting to pick up on that.
It's actually my hobby. I make a cocktail every night. But in Washington, where I first met you, Jim, we have these really great conversations at the bar after work. And I thought it was very interesting that when I looked at the writing that appeared about nuclear weapons and arms control, it was pretty dry. It didn't really match the kind of humorous and enjoyable conversations you might have at a bar. And I felt like it would be a great thing to have a place to talk about these issues in the way that people really talked about them rather than the way that they're often presented.
So obviously it struck a nerve or found an audience. So you have a Twitter account that has a lot of followers. Do you have any sense of how many people read the blog? And how often do you post on that blog today?
Yeah, I post less on the blog today, mostly because I have a group of younger colleagues who I think really have picked up the mantle and started writing.
Okay.
The traffic numbers are not so large, but I often say it's a little bit like the Velvet Underground. You know, the Velvet Underground released tremendously influential records in the late 1960s that very few people bought. But I think somebody observed everyone who bought one started a band, right? So the goal is...
I never heard that. Yeah, I like that. That's good.
The goal is to reach the right audience. And, you know, with the book, I'm trying to go a little bit bigger than that.
So the book is the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. My favorite review of this is that this is the opposite of a warm glass of milk. I told you that I found it a little too real, a little too unsettling. Why write it sort of modeled on a 9/11 commission style investigation after the attack than even a fictional account of sort of the lead up to a war?
Yeah, well, the flip answer to that is, I think a lot of academics try to write novels, and I was really wary of writing awkward sex scenes, which is not really my forte.
And you were good to heed that inner voice.
I think so. So, you know, I wanted to tell a story because I thought that was an effective way of conveying how things might go wrong. But I didn't want to do it in a voice that was kind of Pulp Fiction-y. And I just thought that the language of a commission report was a sort of nice balance. And, you know, I stray from that a bit. It's not as dry as many commission reports. But there is a certain tone of objectivity. And then it was nice because I think if you read it really carefully, maybe there are times when you might get the sense that the commission isn't telling you all of the truth.
Was this your first fiction?
Yes. I had never written a novel before. I'd always wanted to write a novel. But it's hard to find time. And so this was just kind of a magical moment where I got to actually indulge in this fantasy. And it seems to have turned out okay.
And this is what I'm thinking. There was an op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times, actually, first, in the spring of 2017 about the difference between denuclearization and what that means to the North Koreans and what it means to the Trump administration. What is that difference?
That's a really interesting substantive point. It's very strange because in any other region of the world, we never use the word denuclearization. It's always disarmament, right? So people talk about the disarmament of South Africa. They just do not talk about denuclearization. And the reason for that is denuclearization is really a North Korean word. It's actually kind of an old Soviet term that the North Koreans have really made their own. And the North Koreans used it before they had nuclear weapons. And so when they talked about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is why it's so easy for them to say, they're really talking about our nuclear weapons. Now, obviously, the North Koreans know they have the bomb, and so denuclearization has a kind of mutual tone to it. But there is a real difference, because when the Trump administration talks about it, they're talking about it like North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons. But when the North Koreans talk about it, what they really mean is that there's a solution to the nuclear problem on the Korean Peninsula, and that includes the United States, not just Pyongyang.
And is it just the elimination of U.S. nuclear forces, I'm going to say in the region, because they're no longer on the peninsula, or is it U.S. Disarmament as well?
Yeah, you know,
in the broader sense.
It depends. It depends on the North Korean negotiator you get and how that North Korean negotiator is feeling that day. There are some days when the North Koreans treat it very narrowly. And so they talk about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and what they really mean is an end to nuclear threats. But there are other days where North Korean officials talk about it like it's the Prague speech, where it's, a world without nuclear weapons, and then they would join in.
President Obama's Prague speech.
That's right. Yeah. Sorry, yes. So, you know, it's aspirational, and the actual price for the North Koreans kind of varies.
So one of the plot devices you use in your book is imagined presidential tweets from President Donald Trump. How did you find that voice?
Well, you know, it was the hardest thing to write, and I think it's probably the thing that gets criticized the most, because it's very difficult to parody without the parody becoming cheap. So I did a couple of things. I mean, one thing is I took real tweets. There's one particular section of tweets that sometimes gets criticized for being a little goofy, but they're actual Donald Trump tweets about Chuck Schumer, and I just replaced Chuck Schumer with Kim Jong-un. But it was a weird place to be. You know, I spent a lot of time reading things Donald Trump had said and did. And then generally speaking, I pulled back about 80%.
Do you think in the end you captured him or his voice, at least as it is heard or read on a tweet or multiple tweets?
I think I did. I mean, you know, obviously people can disagree.
Yeah.
But there are definitely, you know, there are definitely patterns to his speech. And actually, you know, the depiction of him was pretty difficult. In the end, I decided I would treat him less as a kind of actor and more of a kind of force of nature. And so once I kind of gave over to that idea, that he was just this kind of maelstrom of emotions, I think it was a little easier to get.
So, you know, you are, in addition to writing this book, you are one of the recognized world experts on nuclear issues and on North Korea's nuclear program in particular. I remember from my days in graduate school that when you're talking about we're talking about threats, you need to be worried about capabilities and intentions. So when we look at North Korea, what can we say about their capabilities today, and what can we say about their intentions?
Yeah, well, you know, the way that I do my work, we at the Middlebury Institute, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at images, videos, satellite images, in order to try to reconstruct the actual capabilities. So, you know, we measure missiles, we develop models of how far they can fly. You know, our best judgment, at least mine and the people who work around me, is that North Korea can deliver a nuclear weapon to the United States.
To the continental U.S.?
Yes. The Hwasong-15, which is the big missile that the North Koreans tested in November, that could carry a nuclear weapon-sized payload all the way to Mar-a-Lago. Now, they've only tested it once, so the reliability is a thing that neither they nor we know. But to a first approximation, yes, this is a thing they can do. Intentions are a little more slippery. Although one of the kind of fun things about satellite images is you get to see the propaganda visits that they don't announce. So for example, the North Koreans have built monuments at the sites of all of their big missile tests. And the other day we actually have an image of a big group going and visiting one of the sites. And so there was clearly a big propaganda visit to the museum. But they chose not to publicize it in their own internal propaganda. So I think that tells you something about both the importance of the weapons, but also the decision they've made to downplay them.
So what is your assessment of the Trump administration's approach to North Korea now? A big question and probably a big answer, but...
Yeah, it's not terribly well conceived, is how I would say it. You know,
it's very diplomatic.
Well, you know, it's a little bit tough because I'm someone who thinks North Korea is not going to abandon their nuclear weapons. And so
why do you think that?
Well, I think one reason is the North Koreans have never offered to abandon their nuclear weapons. You know, the South Koreans have said it, the Trump administration has said it, but when one reads what the North Koreans say, the closest they get is this kind of phrase about denuclearization, which I really understand to mean something different. So that's why I say I think it's not terribly well conceived, because I actually am supportive of diplomatic efforts. I think there's been some criticism the president's given away too much. And I don't actually agree with that. But my concern is that I think we're still locked in this idea that the goal of this negotiation is to, in the near term, convince Kim Jong-un to give up his bomb. And I don't think that's going to happen. And the scenario I worry about is, you know, we're going to get to a point where people are going to feel taken advantage of or cheated. And then we could go back to a situation like we were last year, which might be quite dangerous.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, an internationally respected expert on nuclear arms and open source analysis. He's a scholar at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California, and the author of a new book, the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. He's on Twitter, at Arms Control Wonk. You, the book itself sort of describes sort of a momentum towards war from a series of unfortunate incidents, for lack of a better way of putting it. I'm curious, when did you start writing the book? How long did it take you to do it? And how quickly was it on the street? Because it's very fresh.
Right. Well, I wrote it very quickly. You know, I had written an op-ed length version, which inspired the book in the fall of 2017. And I spent the winter break at the Institute basically putting together a first chapter of a book length version. And I finished it by mid-April.
It's so about 4 months.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you want to do some ghostwriting for me? I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's great.
It turned out it wasn't that hard to write. I mean, it, you know, as an academic, you have all these things that you want to say, and this was a new way to express them. So, you know, the manuscript was in by April 20th. I got another chance to make a few round of changes in early June, and then, you know, off to the publisher and out in August.
And was there ever... I don't want to be flip about this question, but was there ever a moment in that timeline where you thought, oh, they're going to get a deal and my book's going to be OBE'd?
Oh, God, no.
No, that never happened.
No. I mean, you know, from my perspective, there is just no evidence that what North Korea is offering is the abandonment of their nuclear weapons. They're offering an opportunity for the United States to live with their bomb, and so they're willing to do certain things, like stop testing and reduce the incidence of these things showing up in state propaganda. They're basically willing to become a kind of version of Israel, where they possess but maybe don't brandish. But that underlying capability, I think they're absolutely committed to retaining. So from a novelistic perspective, that was actually very easy to handle, because the scenario I'm worried about in real life is the scenario I sketch out in the book, which is what happens if we get to the end of this process and it becomes clear that North Korea is not abandoning their nuclear weapons, and what the administration decides is to return to getting tough, right? And they decide to ramp that pressure back up. How might it go wrong? And I'm worried about that in real life for the reasons I describe in the book.
So in some of my own fiction, dystopian fiction, which is aimed at a very different audience, I have been very graphic in describing the effects of a nuclear blast. You chose to do the same here to a different audience in a very different kind of fiction. Why be so graphic?
Well, it's actually an issue that's pretty important to me. I am on the governor of Hiroshima's roundtable on disarmament, so I go to the city every August. And in the course of doing that, I've had the opportunity to come into contact with the stories of Hiroshima survivors. And, you know, Hiroshima is actually a really wonderful city. It's a great place to visit. It's a very vibrant city. It's not all depressing. But when you're there, there is some emotional work you have to do. You know, you do have to grapple with these stories. And so I wanted to use the book as an opportunity to encourage people to go back and look at those stories. So, in fact, the survivor testimony in the book, it's not invented. Those are real Hiroshima survivor stories, and all I've done is strip away the foreign names and places and some of the things that make them seem archaic, like references to streetcars, in order to try to bring the reader a little bit closer to the reality of what happened in August 1945.
So do you think there are generations or people today who don't know what happened in Hiroshima?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
And so it's important to remind, to tell very bluntly, this is what happens when one of these things goes off.
Yeah, I think it's an enormous problem we have, particularly when I was living in Washington, talking about nuclear weapons, which is to speak truthfully about the kind of destruction that they would entail is to be a crazy person. You know, it's to be the person who shows up in the nice conference room and ruins everybody's pastry and coffee by talking about the most graphic, horrible things imaginable. And so I think that we do a lot of things where we create ways to push away that reality so that we can talk about these weapons in a very sanitized way. And I understand why we want to do that. You know, like that's a very human emotion.
Sure.
But it is misleading. You know, it causes us, I think, to miss the reality of the weapons. So,
I mean, it's almost, it's the most important point.
It is.
The horror of what happens here.
It is. And it's, you know, to me, that annual trip to Hiroshima is such an important part of my work life because I find it's very centering. You know, it puts the right problem at the center of my concerns and makes a lot of the other things that, you know, creep in and distract you seem as peripheral as they really are.
So draw a distinction for us between a speculative novel and a work of prediction. How worried should we be? Should we be building fallout shelters?
Well, I wish bookstores would stop putting it in the nonfiction section.
Is that what they do?
They do. Invariably, I get pictures from people who see it in the nonfiction section, and they're really unhappy about this. You know? And my goal is for us to keep it in the fiction section. You know, the way that I think about that question is we are running risks that are unnecessary. So this is a thing that could happen. Those risks are not so great that we should feel fatalistic. You know, we can make different choices and we can reduce the risk. So what I always say is the risk is not large, but it is far too high.
So we're taping this late in 2018. Looking ahead to 2019, what would you foresee in terms of North Korea and the U.S. and nuclear weapons?
Well, I'm worried. And, you know, the reason I'm worried is that the administration has made it very clear that they are expecting a deal that is more detailed than the deal with Iran that the Trump administration walked away from. And there was a recent op-ed by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, where he linked him saying that this all needs to be wrapped up by the end of Trump's first term. And I just don't think that's very likely to happen. And so for me, the big question is, what happens when the administration decides it has to settle for less? You know, one path is that they simply settle for less and we muddle through. So I'm okay with that. It's not the best outcome, but it's better than the one I'm about to say. The other is that they're enraged and that they feel taken advantage of. And I'm very mindful of the fact that before he became the National Security Advisor, John Bolton said that the real purpose of any negotiation with North Korea was to simply show that they were acting in bad faith and to lay the groundwork for more aggressive measures. So my concern, right, is that once we get to a point in this process where it hasn't gone the way the administration has promised, instead of doing what most healthy people do, which is accepting that the world is imperfect and we sometimes have to settle, that we'll go back to the taunts and the threats of 2017.
So that's a very sobering thought. I want to...
I'm cheery at cocktail parties, you know, I
remember.
Don't come to one of my cocktail parties, please.
I want to pivot, though, to some of the work, the other work that you do at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. You rely on open source analysis. All of the stuff that we've talked about today, this is not based upon access to classified information. What is open source analysis for the audience that might not understand it, and how do you bring it to bear on issues like this?
Yeah, we are living in this crazy era of, somebody calls it data ubiquity, which is, you know, like super fancy, but like there's a ton of data. You know, if you just imagine your phone. You know, your phone tracks where you go, you can easily take a picture, you can immediately send that picture to someone. And so, you know, we live in this era where there are all kinds of social media information about places that, you know, are hard to go to. We have satellite images. And what our job is kind of fuse all that information together. So we act kind of like an intelligence agency would, except for we do everything with publicly available information. And so when the North Koreans parade a missile, we watch the video, we measure the missile, figure out how big it is, how much fuel it has. We look at everything right down to the weld lines on the body. When they fire a missile, we look at how quickly it accelerates to figure out how powerful the engine is. When they are building new facilities, we look at them in satellite images. And we don't just look at pictures, we look at radar images so we can see where the vehicles have driven. We look at heat images so we can see if the heat's turned on in the buildings. And our idea is that provides a factual basis, a kind of knowable factual universe of information about foreign nuclear capabilities that we, you know, hope would lead to a more informed debate.
It's pretty amazing that you can get all that data through open source, through non-classified means. Do you use the same techniques looking at Russia, for example?
Oh, yes, yes.
So give us some examples of how that works.
Oh, well, so Russia is a wonderful case because Russia's nuclear test site is up at the Arctic Circle. And so it's very hard to monitor because of the way orbits work. So this is the part at cocktail parties.
I'm actually interested in that.
Because of the way orbits work, it's very hard to get a good satellite image.
Okay.
But it also turns out, you know, most of the year it's dark, or half of the year it's dark. So it's hard to get a good image if there's no light. And it's usually cloudy. And so we have partnered with a couple of companies. One called Planet in San Francisco takes a picture of the entire Earth every day. And so they're able to give us these beautiful color pictures all the time. And we also work with Airbus, which can take radar images, which are great because radar sees right through clouds. So, you know, that's a great example of a place that was hard for even the U.S. intelligence community to monitor in the 1970s and 80s. That we now have publicly available far more data about that site than they did back then.
We've got about 90 seconds left here, and I'm going to try to encapsulate three big questions. Sort of the general, what's the future of arms control today, but with a particular focus on the Trump administration's decisions about INF, New START, and the Iran nuclear deal. You got 90 seconds.
he does this all the time.
You know, but they're all actually related. And so, you know, I think we are entering into a period where arms control has gone out of fashion. And the United States is uninterested, it seems, in striking these kinds of deals. And I think the consequence of that is going to be arms races. They may not be as intense as they were in the Cold War, but I think you're going to see a battery of new systems in Russia, Iran, China, and if things go badly with North Korea, in North Korea. And so I think we're going to go through a period where there is an extremely intensive phase of building. And my hope is when we get to the other side of that, we will have the same recognition that we had in the Cold War, which is that this is wasteful and unnecessary and that there are better choices. You know, it's a shame we have to learn the lesson a second time, but people are people.
That's where we need to leave it. Jeffrey Lewis, thank you so much for being with us. He's Jeffrey Lewis. The book is The 2020 Commission Report. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.